8:30 a.m. KSDP. This is Meet the People for September 11th, 2009. My guest this morning in the studio here is Mr. Donald Enoch. He is a program manager with the State Department of Education. Welcome to the program and to Sandpoint.
Thank you.
You're here in Sandpoint reviewing the special education programs at the school. What have you found out so far?
Well, I think the Sandpoint School District's a very fortunate location, and you've got a beautiful location, first of all. The kids are great. You can kind of get a feel for a school just walking through the hallways and see if they're happy and if there's anything going bad. You know, you can kind of sense it after you've been in education for a while. And these kids are open, friendly. They play well together. They're not afraid to have, a little conflicts with each other in front of the staff that are healthy. I mean, they're healthy, well-rounded kids. You can get that feel right away. The district on whole did very well in the monitoring that we conducted for special education, and that's always a good sign.
Now, how long have you been working in Alaska?
I've been working in Alaska since 1998, and I bounce around a lot because I'm very intensive into the paperwork, and back when I was working for the school districts. Now that I work for the state, I'm kind of on the other side of that, where I'm spotting things that have to be corrected rather than correcting them myself in the field.
Well, what specifically is the purpose of your trip to Sandpoint?
Well, Sandpoint is one of the districts in Alaska that's on a five-year rotation schedule. So every 5 years, we come in to make sure they're on track, they've got their paperwork, and we do go through a process of updating them on regulations and forms that have changed that they may not have been aware of.
And you say the district did well in this audit.
Yes, the districts always seem to do pretty good, but there's always that, you know, there's going to be some things wrong no matter what, because you pay for sins of the past of things that you weren't aware that we switched to a new form, or we started filling this form out a little bit different and things like that. So, but right now, today, I'd say this is one of the best districts I've ever monitored.
And the results officially will be out probably in the near future, but you're not able to release those. Those are the property and the privilege of the superintendent of the school and the school board.
That's correct.
But you say that they get a real thumbs up for their good work. How many students are part of the special education program in Sandpoint?
Oh, I'd guess about 28. I don't look at all of the files. I only do 10 or 11 files based on my time that I'm here. We do a kind of a sampling across the board. And obviously, because this is a smaller district, I can't say which things I did for which disabilities because, you know, the numbers are small here and that identifies people. But in a 10 to 11 student sampling, that gives us a nice spectrum across elementary, middle school, and high school. And we try to do at least a couple students from each school site if we can.
Well, what are the types of things that you look for as you do the audit and you sift through these files?
One of the things we look for is making sure that the parents were notified with enough time to where if they're concerned with this, they can talk to people and they can show up at the meeting prepared. That was one of the things this district did very well, is they seemed to always notify the parents in a timely manner. And if parents requested a meeting be moved, they always accommodated it. And this is one of those school districts where we had very high parent attendance at these meetings, because a lot of times parents get busy or don't want to go. And this is a district where the parents seem to be very interested in what's going on with their students, and that's good.
If you're just joining us on the radio, I'm talking with Donald Enoch. He is a program manager for the State Department of Education. He's here in Sandpoint doing a review of the special education program. What exactly is special education for those of us who may not be familiar with the program?
Well, I'm a product of special education because I had a learning disability when I went to school, so I'm very intimate with the process. Generally, it's a student who everybody else in the school is getting access to what's going on in the classroom, but for a student with a disability, they're not getting access to that same level of education because something's blocking them from getting there. Sometimes it's something as simple as they can't hear well enough to understand what the teacher's saying, and when the teacher turns around and talks towards the chalkboard or the whiteboard or whatever we're using, the student can't hear any of that education thing. So that's a student with like a hearing loss. And, you know, we can fix that with FM trainers and all kinds of things. And all of these different disabilities, there's 13 categories of disabilities that a student can qualify for. And they range from, you know, very simple things to very complex things. Blind and deaf students, obviously, would require a lot more interventions and assistance to access what everybody else is getting in education in the classroom. than, say, a student like me who just had dyslexia.
Well, what kinds of assistance programs are available for students with mild special education needs?
A lot of the mild needs, once they're identified, can be served in the regular classroom by the teachers just being made aware that the student has a problem. For example, a student who has we'll use that hearing loss again for an example, might need to know that the teacher might need to know that student should sit in the front row, make sure that they have a hearing aid that works if they're not using an FM system or something like that, and just make sure that they check with the student to make sure they understood what was said, and when they turn around, a lot of us don't realize that, now that I'm getting up into my older years, that my hearing's slipping, and when people turn around, I'm using their lips sometimes to identify some of the words they said, and a lot of people do this. I wasn't aware that we became, you know, kind of amateur lip readers, and a lot of these students with hearing loss rely on the facial expressions to know what was said, too. So if you make a teacher aware of these things, there may not be a need for special education interventions to move the child to a special training or special services area. They could stay in the regular classrooms as long as the teacher knew what was going on and the students aware of that problem too.
Now, how is a student identified as requiring or maybe needing special education services? Is it the teacher in the classroom? Is it a parent? Is it the principal? How does the student get identified and placed in a program?
Anyone that has a concern for the child and thinks that there might be something going on can make a referral to the school district. The referral is reviewed, and they make a determination whether they should go for a full evaluation session. A full evaluation requires parental consent, and once the parent gives that consent, whatever tests that they deem are necessary, again, and the parent's completely involved in that, they do the testing they feel is necessary, seeing if those test scores help determine something. And then an IEP team, that's the individual education program team, sits down together and decides, does this kid really need these services? And what can we do to help? And is this sufficient? And after a whole big, you know, discussion is done and it's kind of fine-tuned to that individual child, the parent decides, am I going to proceed? So at any time, the parent has the right to say, that's very interesting, but I don't think this is for me or my child.
Now, once you're a part of the special education program or your student is a part of the education program, is it forever the case or can it be changed?
You know, at one point, the student had to meet all of their goals and objectives to be out of special education. But that's changed. In fact, Alaska was the only state to have it on their regulations that a parent could withdraw their consent and their student would no longer be in special education at any time. Now, every single state in the United States has that same regulation requirement.
How do special education programs in Alaska, how do they differ from those in the lower 48?
Well, there's a lot of things I could throw at that, but the basic thing is everything in special education that you could get in the busiest city in, say, California or New York is available in Alaska. The problem is we have some of these remote locations where let's say a parent took a blind and deaf student and wanted to move to the most remote place in Alaska, we still have to provide those services. Unfortunately, we may have to provide those services by offering to move that child and that family to downtown Anchorage where these services are more available. A parent who moves to a remote bush location will always be offered the opportunity to get what that child needs for part of their free and appropriate public education services. But that's not always going to be the case of where we can do it where they want it done.
So you would pay the full cost of moving a family out to Anchorage or to Fairbanks or wherever they needed to go?
If that's what the IEP determined that student needed, that's what has to happen.
How many families are in that situation currently, and how many say, okay, I will accept being moved to a larger city?
Honestly, I wouldn't even have an idea. I do know that there is a boarding home in Alaska for that purpose, and I know there's quite a few families that take advantage of that because they need to for their students. But generally, a lot of the families who have these students with disabilities don't plan to move to someplace super remote where these services may not be available. Another good example would be a student with a lot of medical needs. I wouldn't want to move to, for example, let me think of a good name here, I wouldn't want to move to Bettles, Alaska. That's fly-in only. It has a winter road that is very treacherous with a child who may need access to immediate medical services and a doctor at any time. It's the school's responsibility to make sure the student can access education, but it's not the school's responsibility to make sure that if this child has a seizure or something, there's a doctor standing by, and we do the best we can. But if you've had a parent who insisted on living in a location, we can offer them to have those services where they are available, or we can say, in this location, this is where you chose to be. This is what we can do.
We're talking special education on Meet the People. I'm Kels Thurington, talking with Donald Enoch, who is a program manager with the State Department of Education in Alaska. He is here reviewing the city or the district's special education program. We'll be back in a moment with more discussion with Mr. Enoch right after this.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Alaska wolves are more closely related to Siberian wolves than they are to wolves in Minnesota. That seems surprising since Alaska and Minnesota are connected by land, and Alaska is divided from Asia by the Bering Sea. But that wasn't always the case. Just a few thousand years ago, Alaska was separated from the rest of North America by vast continental glaciers, enormous ice sheets that blocked passage to the south. Those glaciers contained so much water that sea levels worldwide were almost 300 feet lower than today. The Bering Sea was dry, and a great plain stretched from eastern Europe to the Yukon, a landscape called Beringia.
The famous, now extinct prehistoric animals, such as mastodons, mammoths, giant bears, and saber-toothed cats, roamed this landscape. But there were other familiar animals present as well, animals that still live in Asia and Alaska. Muskox, caribou, moose, brown bears, wolverines, ravens, lemmings, and wolves. Two animals that live today can be thought of as Beringian artifacts. The gray-headed chickadee and the Alaska blackfish are now found only in Siberia and northern Alaska. Even more striking, the Alaska blackfish is also found in lakes on three islands in the Bering Sea, St. Lawrence, St. Matthew, and Nunavak, islands that would have been low hills on the Beringian landscape. For Sounds Wild, I'm Kathy Hocker.
And I'm Riley Woodford. Sounds Wild is brought to you by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Shumagin Corporation. Located in Sandpoint, the Shumagin family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sandpoint Tavern, and the Anchor Inn Motel. The Shumagin Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sandpoint, on the web at www.shumagin.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Shumagin Corporation. Hometown Values and Service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
8:30 a.m., KSDP, back on Meet the People. I'm Kels Thurington, talking with Donald Enoch. We're talking about special education. Donald is part of the special education program. He's with the State Department of Education. He's a program manager there. We could actually take a few calls on the air if you wanted. The direct line to call in to the studio is 383-6359. That is 383-6359 if you want to ask a question on the air. Give us a call. We'll do our best to take it. As we wait for our calls to come in, our queue up, let's talk about the perception that some people have about special education, and that is that special education is a means of taking students who don't perform well on standardized tests out of the general population of the school so that it can get past the strict requirements of the No Child Left Behind law. Is that true?
No, that's not accurate. Whether a student's in special education or not, their scores are counted just like any other student's scores. Now, students on a students with a recognized disability may have the advantage of having some accommodations provided to them. Students who reach a high frustration level when they're challenged academically because of their disability may be allowed to have flexible breaks. Rather than having a break when everybody else gets it, they might be able to take a break every 10 minutes to go out, get a splash of water, and, you know, kind of relax a little bit and come back to testing. But since this isn't a timed test, that's not such a big deal. But for these students, it's the difference between doing their best on the test and, you know, just hitting a frustration level where they don't even want to proceed anymore.
So a school district that has poor test results can't come back and say, well, 30 of these students happen to have special education needs, and that's why they didn't perform well.
Well, they can come back and say that. It's just not necessarily accurate.
But is it going to get them off the hook and allow them to continue to get funding at their current level?
That all child left behind includes all children. It doesn't matter if they're on an IEP or not. As a matter of fact, a lot of these students who are on special education plans are used to taking some of these tests. And although they have struggles with academic features, taking a test is sometimes more comfortable for a student with a disability. And these students do tend to pass the tests.
Why would it be more comfortable for a student with a disability to take a test?
Well, if you've had to sit through a psychologist flipping charts and asking you questions and which is better and which is smarter, and a lot of the academic testing that goes on for all of our students these days, they get a little conditioned to being evaluated and being looked at that way. So a state test is really a way of saying, do I know everything that I'm supposed to know to be a high school student? And these students want to show everybody that despite having some challenges academically, they do know what they're supposed to know, and they do know what the school is supposed to be accomplishing for them.
About what percentage of the student body in Alaska has a special education need?
I think we had a generic figure of approximately 10% of students, give or take a few percentage points, qualify for special ed. Whether they're identified is a whole different matter. The actual need, I'll give you an example. With my own disability, I have dyslexia, and it's a fairly mild thing, but with dyslexia, I heard a statistic a long time ago that 1 in 5 people have dyslexia, but out of those people that have it, only 1 in 20 were severe enough to affect them in a long-term way. Mine was severe enough that it was difficult for me to learn how to read until someone said, you have this thing called dyslexia and you see things a certain way, and let me fix that for you. And by using, that's a rare case for me, but I use a colored lens and suddenly all the letters stop bouncing around.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
I've never heard of anyone like that.
Well, I felt stupid for a lot of years until someone said, you've got something going on, let me show you how to fix it. And for a lot of these students, they've been hiding a disability because they feel it's something wrong with them that makes them stupid. And they're not stupid. They just have something that prevents them from getting access to what everybody else is already getting.
Now, you told me before we came on the air that you went to college and graduated in 1998. So you went to college later in life, and you had a couple other jobs. First, you were in the military.
I was in the military as a military policeman for it was about 9 years.
Now, and then you came to Alaska a few years ago in the early part of this decade.
Right.
And you eventually got into special education. Why did you find yourself in special education? Is it because of your history, or did the school district or the Department of Education push you in that direction?
It was a nice combination, really. In the military, I became a detachment sergeant, and that's a small group of guys that all kind of have to work together doing all the jobs. They usually disperse around a whole large team. So you become a jack of all trades, and our students, our soldiers, they were younger soldiers that I was tasked with training. And when you're teaching guys who are young and trying to keep them on task, and it gets boring and repetitive, especially the military texts weren't designed to be, super interactive. I got really good at training these guys to meet their requirements. And I was given a distinction once of all of my troops met a certain skill level that was the highest of all the groups under our battalion. So they said, well, you're doing something different than everyone else is. And they came out to evaluate the type of training I was doing. And it was basically taking into consideration these guys are bored, they need a lot of breaks, and they need to get out and do it hands-on, not just sit behind a book and study the right answers. And that's what made the difference in scores. So when I went to college, I naturally kind of fell into a group that liked teaching, understood the importance of keeping people entertained and active and involved in the processes, and allowing for a lot of mistakes to make those learning connections safely.
Now, as you go around Alaska and you review and conduct these audits on special education programs, you see a lot of students clearly with disabilities. In fact, all the files you review are students who are thought to be somehow disabled, mildly or severely. Are there commonalities that you see in a particular community? For example, when you came to Sand Point, did you find that a lot of the students suffer from the same disability?
Not so much. There are those disabilities that have a higher rating than others. You don't see a lot of blind kids walking around, obviously, so blind would be one of those rare conditions. And there are quite a few that fit a very rare percentile. But the big ones are usually speech, language issues, and learning disabilities, because there's so many of them that fall under that umbrella. And there is quite a few students that get identified, not so much in Sand Point, but in a lot of districts with early childhood developmental delays.
Now, that's interesting, because you said that the number of students kind of on average across the state of Alaska who have a disability is approximately 10%. Now, in Sand Point, we have 28 students and a student body of approximately 100, 110 students. So Sand Point would appear to be higher than the average. How do you explain that?
Out of the 10 files I reviewed, 6 of them had been exited already. So you've got some that are off that 28 count because they were previously in special ed, but they're not now. So, you know, that the ones I'm looking at, it doesn't matter whether they're currently in or they used to be in. The exits really are evaluated to say, did you do the old paperwork correct? So you pay for sins of the past, not just for what you're doing right now in a monitoring process.
Were the students who had exited the program graduates of the program in Sandpoint, or were they still in the school curriculum?
Due to your low numbers, I can't give you an exact, but you guys had special ed students who were graduating. That's always good to see. It's a very positive special ed attribute to have students that were in special ed that got their diplomas.
But what I'm trying to figure out is the... You say that some of the students were no longer part of the special education program because they had fulfilled the requirements. Is that because they had graduated from the school, or because they had actually checked off the list of requirements to exit the program, or their parents had said to the school, you know, Bobby no longer wants to be part of the program? I mean, those are different, you know, exit strategies, clearly.
Yeah, there's about a, I'll give you a low number because some of them are obscure, but there's about realistically 10 ways a student can be exited. And you had a variety of them, including students who graduated, students who moved, students who met their requirements at a younger age and, you know, won't be on an IEP in the future, presumably. Speech and language kids tend to be exited fairly quick because they've met their, you know, a lot of them are having problems with articulation, pronouncing certain words. One of my favorite experiences in one of the northern villages, a student couldn't say yellow. They were saying lello. And I was working with them, with a speech pathologist. But I only got to see the speech pathologist once per quarter. So she would come in, write a plan, and show me how to do these exercises with little or no training in speech. And when the student turns around and says yellow for the first time and their eyes light up, you think, wow, I did that, you know, through a speech pathologist expert who gave me a couple quick lessons to apply to this child. It's really kind of a rewarding experience.
If you want to call into the program, you can do so by dialing 907-383-6359. We're talking about special education, and in particular special education here in Sandpoint, Alaska. And I'm talking with Donald Enoch. He's a program manager with the Department of Education in Alaska, and he reviews special education programs like the one in Sandpoint. They're subject to audits on a five-year basis or every year, depending on how large the program is. We're on a five-year plan. Going back to the question about the number of students who are enrolled or a part of the body of students who participate or are labeled as special education students in Sandpoint, we thought that the number was a little bit high. It's 28. That might be interpreted as being that the school district was more aggressive in looking and treating these problems and doing a better job. Is that possible?
You know, how you would interpret that is really kind of up to you. The files I'm looking at includes files who were exited, files who they're no longer here, and maybe they're a part of another district's 10% now or approximate 10%. There are districts that go significantly more than that and significantly less than that, but I really don't look at that before I come to a school district. I just look at the statistics, pull my 10 or 11 files, and then do my monitoring based on whoever those were. I don't target them specifically for being exited. In fact, I'm trying not to get the exited files because then I can do a more in-depth evaluation of the program and let the school district know exactly how they're doing. If I choose a lot of files that were from days gone by, then they don't really need to know what the sins of the past were. They need to know how they're doing right now today with the staff they currently have. And we had sufficient amount of files that serve that purpose, and I was really impressed. You've got a really good team here, and that's saying a lot from me.
Again, if you want to call into the program, it's 383-6359. Another question for you, Donald, is how does it break down? Are there more boys or girls? And has it break down between natives and non-natives in the special education program?
Well, obviously, Sandpoint has a larger native population than, say, Anchorage or any of the large cities. There's a tendency, a social tendency, and again, I'm going to have to start with saying that this is my personal opinion, not the opinion of the Department of Education and Early Development, but it's my personal opinion based on some research I've been looking at, that there are social things that take place in a classroom when you have teachers from the lower 48 coming up and doing their typical, normal, good job, but they tend to behave in a way that doesn't mesh well sometimes with a native population's culture. And some of the boys will tend to react to that because it doesn't feel the way like a female teacher might be acting in a way that a boy's mother does not act. And it might be pushing a couple of internal buttons for him, making him a little more sensitive or a little more aggressive at times. And these students will act up a little bit, especially when they're being challenged academically. Mm. I would say that traditionally, Alaskan Native culture is a strong culture of we teach our children by showing them what we're doing, living what we do with them, and slowly giving them more responsibility. Responsibility being a key part. I think if most of us remember when we were a teenager, our biggest frustration was we had no control over anything.
Yeah.
Everybody was telling us what to do, and of course, we knew everything. A favorite Mark Twain quote of mine is, when I was 20, I left home, and my dad was an idiot, and I came back at 28, and I was amazed at how much he had learned.
Yeah, I like that quote too, actually. Now, what are some of the things, can you give a few examples of the sorts of things that female teachers from the lower 48 have done or might do that would make it difficult for them to have the relationship that would be expected from Native young men?
Well, if a student becomes, and again, this is my opinion, if a student becomes close with a teacher and gets a level of trust, they tend to start meshing them into the way they feel that they should respond based on every adult they know. And when they don't act the same way that their family and their, you know, their mothers and their aunts and their grandmothers are acting, it's like, why are you so different? You're not supposed to be that way. And they kind of can be, and when you're challenging someone in that environment, it doesn't mesh with the way that they're taught in their home life. So by having someone stand up and read a passage, that's very intimidating in the Western culture. But in the Native culture, that's standing someone up and saying, do something that you have a high probability of failure, when in his natural culture way of learning, he's slowly integrated into this and slowly given more responsibility and slowly held accountable for what he is capable of doing.
Now, what are some of the changes that are taking place in the special education programs across Alaska? You mentioned one is called RTI. What is this new thing?
Well, RTI stands for Response to Intervention / Train. What's the other word I was looking for? Intervention and instruction. There we go.
All right.
we get so locked into our acronyms that we tend to, you know, blow off what the actual words are. But Response to Intervention / Education is not a special ed program, but it will eventually, you know, have relationships with it. It's when RTI is trying to say that there's a student who's not functioning well, and before we say that the student has a disability, which is a fairly aggressive thing to do, we want to make sure that they're getting access to everything possible. I'll give you an example. If a student's having difficulty learning to read and the school is using a phonics-based program, there's a lot of different ways to teach children to read. Just because they're not receptive to phonics doesn't mean that they have a disability. It might mean that they are more receptive to a whole language technique where you teach whole words at a time rather than the broken-down sounds. If a student responds well to that, well, they don't have a disability. They just have a different way of learning that's very standard for all of us having different ways of learning. RTI is really trying to make sure that before a student gets labeled and put into a separate program for a disability, that there truly is a disability at play there that requires that special intervention. If they can learn from a different method or style, RTI is really trying to make sure that that student gets exposed to a variety of different methods and styles that are scientifically researched and proven to be effective.
Any other changes that are major enough to talk about on the radio happening at the Department of Education in Alaska?
Absolutely. We've just recently been permitted, and I don't know if it's on the books yet, but I know that it was voted on in past, that we're changing the term mental retardation to cognitively impaired. Obviously, mental retardation is one of those words that has evolved into being calling someone a negative thing and has a very negative stigma to it. While some of these students that have mental retardation are very capable of working average every day jobs, having no problems, consistent lifestyles. In fact, I think I work with some of them sometimes, but I'm teasing.
Well, I think, yeah, of course, being called a retarded person does have a negative connotation and could make it hard to get a job. But you're right. Some of these people, and I've seen them too, do have the ability to actually function in the everyday world. It may take them longer, but their skills are really there and can be developed.
Well, I don't like to say this very often because I get teased for it quite a bit, but I worked at Wendy's as a manager for a long time. Good stuff, good quality food. we would hire the handicapped fairly regularly, and they were our best performers, not because of their handicap providing some special, trait or skill. It's because they were happy to be doing something that was just like everyone else being treated the same. And that's a strong thing for anybody with any type of disability to be acknowledged for what they're good at and what they can do. Myself, for example, when I had difficulties reading, it wasn't really noticed until I showed I had strengths in other areas. And they said, well, gosh, you're not stupid. You can do all these other things. And then let's take a look at this reading problem. And that's how it got noticed. I was fortunate in that aspect of it. But there are a lot of students who spend their entire time in school just dreading getting up in the morning and going to school to face another day of pretending that they get what everybody else is getting.
So maybe one of the ways we can identify learning disabled students is by noticing discrepancies. If you have a child who is pretty good at reading and writing but really struggles in math or, one subject area, this may be a student who has a disability and should be looked at. Is that a way to look at it?
That's an excellent way to preach the RTI argument, is if they're doing great in reading and they love to write and they're doing fine in science but they're struggling in math, we may be using a method of math instruction that doesn't work for that individual. And a different technique or a different method would be probably more advantageous to that student. I bet we'll see a lot less kids on IEPs, individual education plans for special ed, when we get RTI kind of under a more practiced approach throughout the state. Whether that happens or not in any significant time frame, I have no idea. But if we were using RTI the way it's intended to be used in every district in the state, I would be willing to bet that our special ed numbers would drop significantly over time.
Yeah. Just one final question, and I wanted to ask you about this. The reports are that the number of students or younger number of babies being born with significant cognitive impairments, called retardation, is gone up exponentially. Are you seeing that in your work in Alaska?
I have not. I have not seen that at all. I have seen a significant increase in autism. That is not attributed to better diagnostic testing or any non-biological issues. I've been seeing a lot more autism on the rise, and this is a fairly national statistic where autism used to be such a small portion of our population, and now it's significantly increased. And that's a matter for national concern, and I really hope somebody governmental at the federal level takes interest in that.
Well, thank you very much. I've been talking with Donald Enoch of the Department of Education. He is with the Special Education Unit and was out here auditing our program in Sandpoint and King Cove and the other district schools that are associated with the Aleutians Eastboro School District. Anything else you want to add?
I just love this area. I've spent most of my career in the north end of the state, and coming down south here and seeing the Aleutian areas and a lot of the islands, it's just gorgeous down here, and the people are just wonderful. I don't want to draw a comparison to some of the northern folks I've worked with, but you guys are nice.
Well, good. I'm glad. We've had some nice weather for you, too, and it looks pretty nice outside right now.
Yeah, so I brought some sunshine.
You did. Well, you're down in the tropics for Alaska, anyway. All right. Well, thank you very much, and we'll now go back to our regular scheduled program. I think we're going to go to Science Friday, which is on the air right now.